This 21st century, this age we live in, sinks and swims in a sea of data. 60% of all voters prefer this. 20% of all consumers buy that. Data and statistics shape political campaigns and marketing strategies. They inform many of our choices, from the most trivial to the most important. They even give meaning to our lives. But statistics alone can't tell you which path to choose. It's not just that they can be false or misleading, it's that they're incomplete. It's not enough to know that, say, 4 out of 5 dentists surveyed recommend a certain brand of sugarless gum for their patients who chew gum. If we're planning on using that data to drive strategy or to make sense of our world, we need to know a lot more. Where do those 4 dentists live and practice? Who are their patients? And what's up with the holdout? Why won't that stubborn 5th dentist sign on? I bet you think you know what's coming next. An episode on big data and artificial intelligence. Well, that episode is in the hopper. We'll close this second season of Unraveled with it. Today's episode also has to do with data, but it's about the difference between data and knowledge. The way we can move from what we see to what we know. Here's an example. By the early 2000s, researchers at Dana-Farber and elsewhere knew that a certain protein appeared in many tumors taken from lung cancer patients. 4 out of 5 patients, actually. So, based on that data, doctors started treating those patients with a drug that inhibited the protein, a drug called Iressa. Unfortunately, for reasons that weren't clear at the time, most patients didn't respond. But there was a small percentage of patients, about 1 out of 10, who did.
People called it a Lazarus-like effect. They would be on their deathbed, they would take Iressa, and they would get up and they would walk away.
So how can doctors know which of their patients is Lazarus? How can they know which ones will respond to a drug and which ones won't? In other words, how can they interpret data so it makes sense? That, of course, is the question. And it's the subject of this episode about precision medicine, an episode which begins with a riddle and ends with a roadmap. I'm Ken Schulman, and this is Unraveled, a Dana-Farber Cancer Institute podcast. Lung cancer is, unfortunately, the leading cause of cancer death. In the U.S., more than 100,000 people succumb to the disease every year. 2 million die of lung cancer each year worldwide. There are 2 major categories of lung cancer. The largest of these, by far, is non-small cell lung cancer. And the largest subgroup in non-small cell lung cancer is adenocarcinoma. Adenocarcinoma is an aggressive form of cancer. It's almost always incurable. 5-year survival rates are low. How low? It depends. It depends on whether the cancer has spread when first diagnosed, and on a lot of other factors. Besides, survival rates are statistics, not certainties. They're data gleaned in the rearview mirror, not read in the crystal ball. Now, these survival rates aren't meaningless. They can suggest, with reasonable accuracy, that 4 out of 10 patients with lung adenocarcinoma won't live past the 5-year mark. But they can't tell an individual patient if they're one of those 4. Like most statistics, this one applies to groups, not to single patients. Adenocarcinoma, like all cancers, shows up as a glitch in the growth program. The signals that regulate cell replication get crossed or squelched or distorted. In the resulting chaos, cells start dividing on their own, and the proteins that normally slow down or stop the frenzy are silenced.
So what happens is that it's a little bit like putting your foot on the accelerator.
That's Bruce Johnson. He ran the lung cancer program at Dana-Farber from 1999 to 2013. He's still at Dana-Farber now as senior advisor to the president. Cell division, he tells us, is triggered by a switch, by a receptor, by many receptors actually, on the cell's surface. In normal circumstances, in healthy growth, an agonist, another protein, binds with that surface receptor. And that surface receptor, now activated, emits a flurry of signals that in turn trigger even more signals downstream. The entire cascade of signals orchestrates the process by which one cell becomes 2. Now, in this type of cancer, Johnson explains, a switch called EGFR, the epidermal growth factor receptor, just goes rogue. It turns on all by itself.
As I said before, it's like putting your foot on the accelerator and leaving it on there. And the term we use for it is constitutive activation, meaning that the receptor is turned on. It doesn't need an agonist. It doesn't need a signal to turn on, number one. Number two is that there's not a signal that tells it to turn off. So it sends a signal to the cell that it should have unmitigated growth.
35 years ago, when Johnson started his career, there were no approved treatments for non-small cell lung cancers, including adenocarcinoma. The only treatable lung cancer was small cell lung cancer.
And there we used conventional chemotherapy, and we were doing that going back in the 1960s and 70s. We didn't have any therapy for non-small cell lung cancer, and in the 1990s we got chemotherapy. And it was sort of stagnant for about 15 years.
With chemotherapy, lung cancer patients got a few extra months before the cancer returned. But as time passed and as the field evolved, researchers gradually traced the network of pathways that generated and sustained lung cancer. Much of their work was piecemeal, single tiles or discoveries that only made real sense after they were set into the mosaic with all the other tiles. One of these tiles was the EGFR protein, the epidermal growth factor receptor. Researchers noticed that close to 90% of lung cancer samples they examined in the lab contained unusually large quantities of EGFR. The same protein shows up big in a lot of other cancers, too. EGFR is one of those switches, one of those surface receptors that start the ball rolling in cell division. So it made sense at the time to conclude that a mutant EGFR protein could be driving lung cancer. Therefore, it also made sense to treat lung cancer patients with drugs that would inhibit the EGFR protein. By inhibiting the EGFR protein, doctors hoped to stop or even reverse tumor growth. So doctors, including Bruce Johnson, began treating lung cancer patients with an EGFR inhibitor called gefitinib. The responses were dramatic, like Lazarus from the grave, but those responses weren't widespread. Only 1 in 10 patients showed improvement. The remaining 9 showed no response at all. Researchers and doctors were justifiably baffled because they couldn't see any connections or shared characteristics linking that lucky 10%.
There were certain clinical subgroups that were more likely to respond than others. So the things that we had noticed were that women were more likely to respond than men. People who'd never smoked were more likely to respond than those who had a smoking history. It was also observed that folks from Japan were more likely to respond to these molecules.
So that's a good one. A woman, a non-smoker, and a person from Japan walk into a bar. Where do you go with that? And what on earth, if anything, did these 3 groups have in common? 2001 is a watershed year for cancer science and treatment. It's the year that a drug called Gleevec was approved for a relatively rare blood cancer called chronic myelogenous leukemia. Now, lots of drugs are approved every year, and all of them in some way are novel. But Gleevec was a quantum leap.
Chemotherapy mostly is directed at the idea that cells are either proliferating too fast or they're just making too much DNA, and we just need to disrupt that.
That's Dana-Farber Dr. Bill Sellers.
But that doesn't really say anything about the cause of the cancer. What's the root cause?
The root cause. Cancer, as we've said many times, is the result of a misprint in the cellular growth program, a genetic typo that sends the cell-making machinery into a dangerous overdrive where it churns out hordes of maverick cells. Chemotherapy attacks these maverick cancer cells and, hopefully, kills them. Gleevec, on the other hand, keeps these cells from being born. If chemo is a machine gun, cutting down everything in its path, Gleevec is a sniper's rifle, a targeted therapy that shuts down the machinery that makes the rogue cells in CML. How does it work? It blocks the fusion of 2 genes located in the so-called Philadelphia chromosome. This is the fusion that drives CML. Blocking the fusion stops the disease.
the world was on fire about this clinical result because essentially every patient was responding and there was minimal toxicity. And, you know, this first idea of a smart molecule rather than just sort of bluntly trying to kill cancer with chemotherapy.
In late spring of 2001, Sellers and his Dana-Farber colleague Matthew Meyerson were on a plane together from Geneva. They were returning from a conference they'd attended in Switzerland. It was an exciting time for cancer science. The field was energized by Gleevec, a discovery that opened a brave new world for research and therapies. And thanks to the Human Genome Project, which was nearing completion, we had a pretty good idea about the structure of our DNA. But the cancer genome, the galaxy of genetic mutations that drove cancer, was almost completely uncharted. And that was the galaxy that Gleevec had opened for exploration. It was a rare moment when the universe seemed to be made not of atoms, but of possibility. Still, there was reason for caution. Skeptics pointed out that Gleevec had worked in a hematological malignancy, in a blood cancer, and a rare one at that. Sellers and Meyerson wanted to find out whether something similar could be done with solid tumors. The pair talked almost nonstop for the entire 8-hour flight to Boston.
And Bill said, you know, we can't sequence the whole genome. It's way too expensive at that time. He said, we should just sequence something that's really important.
That's Matthew Meyerson. Today, he holds the Charles A. Dana Chair in Human Cancer Genetics at Dana-Farber. In 2001, he and Sellers were relatively low-ranking faculty members.
And he said, you know, Gleevec tells us the receptor tyrosine kinases are really important. Let's sequence the receptor tyrosine kinase genes. And I said, oh, Bill, that's a great idea. So we decided to do it.
We've talked about kinases in previous episodes, about those enzymes that help drive cell division. Gleevec, the game-changing targeted therapy, stops cancer by shutting down a receptor tyrosine kinase, EGFR. The growth factor present in large numbers in lung cancer and many other cancers is also a receptor tyrosine kinase. Now, there are about 500 kinases in the human genome. A small minority of these belong to the tyrosine group. That minority includes the enzyme that Gleevec shuts down, and, as mentioned, it includes EGFR. But even that small minority, the tyrosine kinase group, was still too big a field for Meyerson and Sellers to scan. They needed to fine-tune their search even more, to maximize their resources, and to leverage their chances of hitting pay dirt, of producing actionable data, knowledge that could lead to effective targeted therapies for cancer.
We realized, well, actually, it's too expensive to sequence all the receptor tyrosine kinase genes. We need to sequence small pieces of them. And we found the pieces that have the most mutations, and we started our sequencing in those pieces that have the most mutations. So that's how we started the project.
Gene sequencing was a lot slower and a lot more expensive 20 years ago than it is today. Sellers and Meyerson narrowed their search even further, focusing on just three cancers, prostate, lung, and glioblastoma. They sifted through close to 2,000 exons, those pieces of DNA that code for proteins. Of the many kinases they sequenced, four emerged that were of interest. Four genes that coded for some of the most common aberrant proteins that flourished in those three cancers. One of those four genes was the EGFR gene. The two junior faculty members weren't working in a vacuum. There was a lot of information available about EGFR, but none of it was conclusive. None of it showed a clear path towards treatment or hinted at why only 1 in 10 patients responded to EGFR inhibitors. The information came in scattered, like single tiles in a mosaic that couldn't yet be read. Here's what Meyerson and Sellers did know. They knew from clinical reports that EGFR inhibitors like gefitinib were far more effective in patients from Japan than they were in patients from the United States. And like Bruce Johnson and everyone else, they didn't know why that was. Now, the next part of this story will appear quite differently to different people. As in an optical illusion where you either see a human face or you see a camel. If you believe in fate, this part will read as destiny. If you believe in coincidence, it will read as dumb luck. So here it is. In order to sequence DNA from lung cancer patients, in order to analyze the genes that coded for the receptor tyrosine kinase in EGFR, Meyerson and Sellers needed tumor samples, lung cancer tumor samples. The lung cancer samples that the pair found to work with at Dana-Farber, the ones they would sequence, just happened to come from Japan, from the country where patients, for reasons still unknown, seemed to respond to gefitinib in greater numbers, the very country where the EGFR inhibitors work best. The thing is, Meyerson and Sellers didn't choose to work on Japanese samples. The samples just happened to be there. They'd been brought to Dana-Farber by a visiting surgeon from Tokyo. He left them behind when he returned home.
And we had a bunch of lung cancer samples from him. And we were supposed to use them for another project. And that project never quite got off the ground. So when we started this project, I said, you know what? This guy's been waiting patiently. We should use his samples. And that was actually the rationale.
So Meyerson and Sellers started sequencing the DNA from the Japanese samples. They found several mutations in the gene for EGFR, the epidermal growth factor receptor. The discovery looked promising. These mutations were located in a region of the gene that Meyerson had already linked to other mutations linked to lung cancer. So the site felt right. There was also an amino acid residue on the site, similar to another residue linked to yet another mutation tied to cancer. And there was more. It wasn't just that this first sample, this first patient with the EGFR mutation, was from Japan.
It was a woman patient. Women had responded better to gefitinib than men. It was a patient with lung adenocarcinoma, the subtype that had responded best to gefitinib. And finally, this patient was a non-smoker, and non-smokers had responded better. So we immediately thought, okay, this is probably the explanation for why gefitinib is working in these patients, because they have EGFR mutations.
So we're back to the bar joke, except this time it has a punchline. Japan, female, non-smoker with adenocarcinoma. This one patient, the one with the EGFR mutations in her DNA, just happened to straddle all the disparate groups that had responded to gefitinib, to the EGFR inhibitors. Even if you don't believe in fate, it's hard not to see an invisible hand behind this discovery. And the discovery? It wasn't fully confirmed, but from their work, Meyerson and Sellers were pretty sure that the patients who responded to gefitinib, to the EGFR inhibitor, would all display the same genetic mutation. Whether or not the drug worked didn't depend on whether the tumors showed large amounts of the EGFR protein, because many tumors showed large amounts of the EGFR protein, and most of those patients didn't respond to the drug. Successful treatment, it seemed, depended on whether or not the patient showed a mutation in the EGFR gene, even though the drug targeted the EGFR protein. Let me repeat that. It didn't matter whether patients had the EGFR protein in their tumors, because patients weren't responding to the therapy based on the makeup of their tumors. They were responding to it based on the makeup of their DNA. We spoke earlier about the difference between data and knowledge, between information that's interesting and information that's actionable. It's interesting, for example, to learn that the EGFR genetic mutation that Meyerson and Sellers observed in the lab shows up in approximately 40% of patients from Japan and East Asia, and that the same genetic mutation only shows up in about 10% of US patients. But what do you do with that? Give the drug to all Asian patients and hope the coin comes up heads instead of tails? In order for that information to become actionable, we need a way to get the drug to the patients we know will respond to it and not waste the time of patients who may not have a lot of time to waste with therapies we're pretty sure won't work. In short, we need a screen.
Until that time, lung cancers were treated as one size fits all. And this helped identify a subset of lung cancers that were defined by this genetic alteration and that was predictive of efficacy of treatment.
That's Pasi Yane. He directs the Lowe Center for Thoracic Oncology at Dana-Farber. In 2003, Meyerson and Sellers sat down with Yane and with Bruce Johnson to share their findings. At the time, Yane was a fellow in Johnson's lab. Johnson was enthusiastic and wanted to collaborate. Under his direction, Janne started collecting lung cancer biopsy samples from patients treated at Dana-Farber. He and Johnson also studied lung cancer cell lines to see which of them responded to gefitinib, the EGFR inhibitor. There was one cell line that Johnson had brought to Dana-Farber from the National Cancer Institute, where he'd previously worked, cell line NCI-H3255.
And in the course of those studies, we helped identify that there was one outlier cell line that was particularly sensitive to an EGFR inhibitor. And we ultimately decided to sequence those cell lines, the sensitive and resistant ones, and noted the outlier cell line actually had an EGFR mutation.
It was the same observation that Meyerson and Sellers had made. Janne and Johnson treated several hundred lung cancer patients with gefitinib. As clinicians in multiple locations had already observed, some of these patients responded dramatically to the inhibitors, while others did not respond at all.
And so I helped identify those individuals along with Dr. Johnson. And then as we were putting the story together, we ultimately studied those tumors from the patients that were both sensitive and resistant to the medicine clinically, and noted that individuals whose tumors responded to the medicine all harbored EGFR mutations, where that was not the case in the patients whose tumors did not respond to the medicine.
This was confirmation, and this was actionable. Working in parallel, both research pairs had found a predictive biomarker. They'd located a piece of information that, if properly harvested, could predict with reasonable certainty whether a specific drug would work in a specific patient. Meyerson and Sellers and Johnson and Janne published their findings in Science magazine, and it didn't take Dana-Farber very long to act.
The original publication happened in April of 2004, and by August of 2004, we have set up a system where we would be able to sequence patients' tumors before they started on any therapy. Our colleagues in pathology set up a clinical test, and then we were able to order it as a test and test individuals' tumors, whether or not they had the mutation, and allowed us to then choose the EGFR inhibitor therapy. And that's still done today, and it's one of the most common molecular tests that is done in lung cancers around the world today.
Today, when a patient with lung adenocarcinoma comes to Dana-Farber for treatment, tissue from their tumors is scanned for nearly a dozen mutations. There are targeted treatments available for almost 40% of all lung cancers. Some of these can even substitute for chemotherapy. Gefitinib, the original EGFR inhibitor, has been replaced by second-generation inhibitors, drugs that are far more aggressive with the mutant protein and, at the same time, far less toxic for the wild or healthy form. End result? Tumors shrink faster, remission lasts longer, and side effects are milder. It's a thrill for doctors like Pasigliani to see those results in patients and even more in their scans.
A scan is something you can see with your own two eyes. You can see a before and after, person was feeling better. It's a remarkable feeling to see something that you have been involved in impact another human being. You know, being in a cancer center, you know, we have a very focused mission, and that is to help our patients. But to be able to see that with your own two eyes, it's great. It's fantastic.
The article in Science, the article on EGFR mutations, is a sort of Magna Carta of medicine. Since 2004, the year it was published, it's been cited more than 10,000 times. If you're wondering what that means, consider that for most papers, anything over 150 citations is like batting 300. 10,000 citations is like winning the Triple Crown 10 years in a row. And the work behind the article, the work by Johnson and Janne and Meyerson and Sellers and others, would signal the beginning of a promising era in cancer therapy, the era of precision medicine in lung cancer and in many other cancers with solid tumors, an era where doctors test for predictive biomarkers, where they screen individual tumors for specific pieces of genetic information, information that can guide doctors towards tailor-made, timely treatments.
We knew in the case of Gleevec a really clear connection between a molecular alteration, in this case the Philadelphia chromosome, and the response to therapy. I think that the EGFR discovery really brought that same concept to what we call the solid tumors, you know, the area of, you know, lung cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, prostate cancer. And it said, okay, we can build molecularly targeted therapies, in particular in lung cancer. And it led to a flood of new targeted therapies.
For lung adenocarcinoma patients, precision medicine has changed the landscape and stretched the horizon. With the latest generation EGFR inhibitors, remission can last as long as 2 years, and it's not unusual for some patients to survive for 3 years, 5 years, and even more. But, and there's always a but, while this era of precision medicine is well underway, it's nowhere near completed. There are other cancers and other drug sensitivities to be linked to other genes. And even in precision medicine, there's drug resistance. EGFR inhibitors are good, but they're not forever. Eventually, no matter how robust the response, cancer finds a way to outfox or outflank or simply outlast most small molecules and antibodies. Much of Passiani's work today is on drug resistance.
And so what we're trying to understand is, how do you best combat resistance? Do you wait for it to happen and then figure out why resistance happens and then develop a new strategy to overcome resistance? Or do you develop a sort of a cocktail of medicines from the very beginning to delay or prevent resistance from happening in the first place? And so we're trying to model many of those scenarios in the laboratory and then ultimately take those findings and test them through clinical trials.
And there it is again, the bench-to-bedside loop at Dana-Farber that supports and encourages this brand of breakthrough. The commitment to harvest information, to gather isolated shards and tiles, and over time, working as a team, to transform those fragments into a mosaic, into a big picture that shows us not only how cancer works, but also how we can stop it. In 2005, 1 year after the landmark publication in Science, Bill Sellers left Dana-Farber for an 11-year stint at Novartis. There, as head of cancer drug discovery, he brought almost 40 drugs into phase 1 trials. 10 of those drugs are approved for treatment now, an astonishing result for oncology, where only one out of every 20 phase 1 therapies makes it to market. Sellers returned to Dana-Farber in 2016 as a senior faculty member. He recalls with fondness the work he did with Meyerson.
Good thing we were young, and I think also it was good that Matthew is bold, too. So, like, to take a step like this for our careers at sort of a junior level required some boldness. And I think this is why the partnership was exciting to me, because I know for myself, I don't think I would have had the guts to do it by myself.
Meyerson, too, is grateful for the teamwork.
You know, one of the really special pieces of this story, I would say, is partnership. We established early on a joint group that ended up being a wonderfully fruitful joint group.
Meyerson and Sellers and Yanni and Johnson press on at Dana-Farber, looking for cures, not the cure. They know from experience that there's no magic bullet. They know that discoveries that lead to new knowledge can also lead to new challenges, and that those challenges grow more complex at each new level. But they also know, almost 20 years after they published their EGFR findings, that there is real progress, that there's momentum, and that the best way to maintain that momentum is by working together.
All of us, you know, this, you know, EGFR discovery, we made it first discoveries in 2003, we published the paper in 2004, but all four of us are continuing, you know, Bruce, Posse, Bill Sellers and I, we're continuing to work together closely today. And so I think that that partnership piece is a really special thing that has enabled us. And it's also a really special feature of Dana-Farber science in particular that's been a great part of our scientific culture.
Next time, when two drugs are better than one, Unravel takes a deep dive into combination immunotherapy.
The immune system is a really powerful system if you unleash it. It defends us against disease. And the thinking for over 100 years had been, if you could just get the immune system to attack the cancer, that would be wonderful.
I'm Ken Schulman, and this is Unraveled, a Dana-Farber Cancer Institute podcast.
What is it about Dana-Farber that makes it such a powerful adversary against cancer? It's hundreds of Dana-Farber researchers and clinicians making new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber discoverers. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, nothing is as effective against cancer as a relentless succession of breakthroughs. Go to dana-farber.org/stories and see how what we do here changes lives everywhere.